Welcome to Twice Blessed, a Yeshiva University Strauss Center podcast exploring Torah and Western thought. I'm your host, Shayna Trepido, and this season we're examining Shakespeare and the Hebrew Bible. It is a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, director of Yeshiva University Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. He's also the rabbi of Congregation Sheareth Israel in Manhattan, known as the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue. It is the oldest Jewish congregation established in North America in 1654. A graduate of Yeshiva University, he also studied at Yale Divinity School in Princeton, where he earned his doctorate in religion. Rabbi Soloveitchik, or Soli as he is known among friends, is an internationally known speaker and writer who has authored numerous essays on theology, politics, diplomacy, and the impact of Judaism and faith on America from its foundings until today. You can find his essays in the Wall Street Journal, First Things, Commentary, and so many other publications, as well as numerous lectures and videos online. Through the Strauss Center, I have directly benefited from his scholarship and wisdom by joining many of his classes over Zoom this year, and I've learned so many things, including, but by no means limited to, the Talmudic intricacies touching Henry VIII's divorce and the halachic virtues of Glencairn whiskey glasses. Rabbi Soloveitchik, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It's great to be having this conversation with you. Thank you for your kind words, and thank you for the privilege of teaching with you.
It's a pleasure. So as you know, this podcast is indebted to the Strauss Center, and it is a project that dovetails with our students' year-long exploration of Shakespeare and the Hebrew Bible through reading groups, seminars, guest lectures. But before we dive into all of that, perhaps you can just give us a very brief overview of the Strauss program, its mission, vision, and maybe why you chose to have them explore Shakespeare and Jewish thought this year.
Sure. The Strauss Center is dedicated to educating students in the great works, first and foremost, of the Jewish tradition and also of the Western tradition. And we produce courses that seek to create a conversation between the two so that students will learn to study great Western texts through a Torah lens, through the wisdom of Jewish tradition, pondering thereby how Jewish ideas have impacted the intellectual development of the West, what tensions might exist between Jewish and Western tradition, and how a study of these great works can actually inspire us as Jews living today. We create courses such as Jewish Ideas in American Democracy, where we read great Jewish texts about government side by side with books such as The Federalist Papers, Tocqueville, Locke's First and Second Treaties on Government. We have a course called Rembrandt and the Rabbis, where we study Rembrandt's paintings specifically of scenes from the Hebrew Bible, and we ponder how Rembrandt's own interactions with the Jews of his day might have actually influenced the exegetical and artistic choices that he made. And we taught this past year a course called Shakespeare and the Bible, where we studied specific plays by Shakespeare. We thought about what biblical allusions might exist in Shakespeare's actual play, what biblical themes Shakespeare is exploring and struggling with, and how a greater familiarity with Shakespeare's plays can actually, again, inspire us in our further exploration of wisdom. And it's been an absolutely wonderful experience to look at Shakespeare from a rabbinic lens, from a Jewish lens, from the Torah lens, over the past many months.
So I had the pleasure of, you know, as I mentioned, joining some of those sessions with you, hearing the students. And I noticed in the plays that you chose to focus on, The Merchant of Venice, Richard II, Henry, or the Henriette, Macbeth, Hamlet, King Lear, I couldn't help but notice not a lot of romances and comedies. And I'm just curious if it's just that you found that a smart pedagogical choice depicting monarchy, or was this personal preference? How do you choose your texts?
Yeah, well, of course, technically, The Merchant of Venice is a comedy, right?
True.
Not from the Jewish perspective, it's not, but Shakespeare wrote it as a comedy. So we had both a course, and then we also had a series of seminars outside classes where we chose a bunch of different plays for our Strauss students to study. For the course on Shakespeare and the Bible, I chose The Merchant of Venice and Hamlet specifically because I saw great potential to explore important biblical themes as well as obviously the important question of Shakespeare and the Jews, anti-Semitism in England. So but if you're approaching Shakespeare from a Jewish perspective, The Merchant of Venice seems an obvious choice. And with Hamlet, I was interested in pursuing a very specific theory put forward by the scholar Jason Rosenblatt about the rabbinic connection to the history of Henry VIII's marriages and how that might play out in Hamlet specifically. So in those two plays, I had a specific issues I wanted to address. For the seminars that we taught outside, where we studied Henry's plays that were largely his history plays, there I think it's probably my own personal preference. I have a great deal of interest in royalty. I've watched a lot of plays and movies about royalty in history, from Henry V to The Lion King, and many other great masterpieces about the nature of kingship. And since we teach a great deal about political thought and the nature of government in the Strauss Center, following up courses about American democracy and Zionism with Shakespeare's great political works seemed like the natural choice.
So maybe this would be a good time to turn to the plays themselves, specifically sure. those that focus on kingship. And I thought maybe we could start with Richard II in our discussion of how the Hebrew Bible echoes in Shakespeare's work. And I find that specifically here with this repeated use of the term anointed, which we know is how the high priests and kings were anointed as divinely appointed in Tanakh. Now, anointed comes up in the other history plays and really throughout Shakespeare, but it's used 5 times in Richard II, more than in any other play. And maybe since Richard II is not one of Shakespeare's more popular works, a quick summary for listeners is justified. So it's the end of the 14th century, and Richard II has been on the throne for about 20 years. And when the play begins, there's this dispute between a nobleman and Richard's cousin, Henry Bolingbroke, over the murder of their uncle, the Duke of Gloucester. Now, ultimately, both men are exiled, but Bolingbroke returns after the death of his father, John of Gaunt, and then proceeds to gain support and take the crown from Richard, thus becoming King Henry IV. The deposed Richard is murdered in prison, and after hearing of Richard's death, the play ends with Henry confessing that his soul is full of woe, and then declaring, "I'll make a voyage to the Holy Land to wash the blood off from my guilty hand." Now, central to medieval political theology is the belief in the divine right of kings. And the unanswered question of the plays, of course, is Henry indeed a guilty usurper of God's anointed, or the next bearer of God's favor who must replace a failed king? One really pointed use of the word anointed comes up early in the play when John of Gaunt's wife urges him to avenge the murder of his brother Gloucester. Now, Gaunt actually suspects Richard, but then explains why he can't really do anything about it.
God's is the quarrel, for God's substitute, his deputy, anointed in his sight, hath caused his death. The which, if wrongfully, let heaven revenge, for I may never lift an angry arm against his minister.
We have another courtier, Carlyle, reminds, you know, the audience that the power that hath made you king hath power to keep you king in spite of it all. And Richard believes this, which we could discuss as maybe a problem. But Richard says, not all the water in the rough sea can wash the balm from an anointed king. So we have so many of these wonderful lines. But maybe can you unpack for us before we go any further what it means to be anointed?
So to be anointed in their context means to be anointed. It's part of the coronation process, usually by, obviously, today it's done in England by the Archbishop of Canterbury, and I think that goes back a long time. And of course, not in the time period of Richard II, but since Handel, coronation hymn, and I believe there were biblical allusions going back before that, as well as part of the English coronation ceremony. But the coronation hymn is psukim, verses from the Book of Kings, which is Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet anointed Solomon king, and all the people rejoiced and said, long live the king. That's the Handel's words, which is a takeoff of the original verse in Kings. And so to be anointed for the English, what the coronation ceremony was saying was that to be anointed is to be anointed by God and to be anointed by an archbishop for these Christian kings and for this Christian society would be seen as akin to being anointed by the prophet of God. They are placing themselves from their perspective squarely in the place of King David. Now, obviously, that's going to be challenged in England at some point. And indeed, one of the themes in Richard II is what happens when someone challenges that, when you challenge that notion of the king being the anointed by God. But that's the central theme. And of course, there are biblical allusions at all points because, as I said, they are seeing themselves as modeled after the original anointed kings in the Hebrew Bible. That's what's taking place. And this is a long tradition in England.
So maybe we could push a little bit into the controversy over that first anointment.
Sure.
The first Mashiach Hashem, like the first anointed king, is not David. It's Saul. How might a deeper understanding of that that narrative help us read something like Richard II?
Yeah, so it's actually terrific, it helps tremendously, and then it helps and inspires you to think about these themes when you then return to the Bible and approach it anew. Because, of course, what you're referencing from John of Gaunt is, and John of Gaunt, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I've heard, just from what I've heard from Shakespeare scholars commenting on this, it's striking because John of Gaunt gets, you know, one of the great speeches in Shakespeare describing England, before he dies.
This sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself against infection and the hand of war, this happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall or as a moat, defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands. This blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England.
He's basically portrayed as this great prophet in Richard mm-hmm. II. And from what I've heard, Shakespeare scholars say he's actually kind of a terrible person. I don't know if that's true or not. But I don't know enough about John of Gaunt to say, but I'll have to look it up. But
sure. Well, if you do, I would recommend a great book by John Norwich called Shakespeare's Kings. And he definitely goes through what Holinshed reports. I mean, we can't read Richard II as history. We have to read it as performance, but... Sure.
But from what I think they know that that's whenever Shakespeare scholars talk about where there's a tension between what Shakespeare chooses to show. And there's always discussion, mm-hmm. especially in the history plays and in the Roman plays. Is he being fair to Richard III? Is he being fair to Henry V? Is he being fair mm-hmm. to Cetra? Right. I think one of the things I mentioned is that that John of Gaunt is because for me, if you watch the series, this Hollow Crown, the Hollow mm-hmm. Crown, which is of course also referenced from one of the great speeches of Richard II. So the series of productions, the Hollow Crown. So Patrick Stewart plays John of Gaunt, and in an absolutely terrific performance. Even though for me, he'll always be Captain Jean-Luc Picard from Star Trek: The Next Generation, but still. But he gives these speeches because he's one of the great Shakespearean actors, Patrick Stewart. Mm-hmm. So he does this absolutely wonderful job. And basically, Gaunt is struggling with this tension, which is the tension that plays itself out throughout many of Shakespeare's plays, which is, on the one hand, if you believe someone to be the anointed of God, that means that you can't do anything to undo that kingship on your own. Kingships can be undone, but only God can undo a kingship. Right. On the other hand, then, how do you handle a situation where the anointed king is absolutely unfit to rule and has surrounded himself, as Richard II has, and this is emphasized by the great political speech given by the gardener in Richard II, he surrounded himself with sycophants. So and turned himself essentially into an idol, right? Richard II compares himself to Jesus at different points in the play. So he's basically divinizing himself. He's turning himself into a god, which is turning monarchy into idolatry. Monarch rules by God's grant, but the constant concern in the Bible is that the monarch thinks that he is God. And so that's a central tension. And of course, these tensions play out in the Bible, both before Saul's anointing, where one of the concerns is that the Israelites ask for a king like all the nations. And God sees that as a rejection of himself, because kings themselves are made in the ancient world into divine beings. And then once Saul is anointed, one of the great themes that plays out is David's refusal, even though Saul is seeking to kill David. David refuses to strike Saul to remove the threat to David's own life, because he has such reverence for the fact that that Saul is the anointed of God. Even though David has himself already been anointed by Samuel and been told that he's the future king, he still believes that he has to wait for God to act. And so what you do when you have an anointed king who is now, through his own actions, proving that he is unworthy of continuing the monarchy, what do you do in that case? And that's what's playing out in Richard II. And perhaps if you, and this is, again, you would know more about this than me, if this is more controversial question, but if Shakespeare is planning these plays about the Plantagenets as one united whole, right, whether this is for him, as it were, the overthrowing of Richard II is, as it were, an original sin, right, that will then play itself out through all of the wars, all the way through the War of the Roses.
Well, there's support for that. Absolutely. There's this, I mean, you just mentioned John of Gaunt's kind of his famous deathbed speech.
Yes.
Where he turns to prophet, or he turns the tongues of dying men are often given to prophecy. And if we look at that speech by Patrick Stewart here, he prophesizes that Richard II, under his rule, England will come to ruin. So,
The Bishop of Carlisle says that as well. He basically prophesies that England will come to ruin as well.
What's been taken up also by scholars is that still there's a little bit of equivocating here. Is this historical moment, the plays 1595, 96, we have thereabouts, the Hundred Years' War is long over. So, retroactively reading this, is the Shakespeare presenting, like a Monday morning quarterback? See, the overthrow of Richard was therefore licensed, or not licensed, this objection to authority. Gaunt specifically seems to implicate the downfall of England through Richard, as you mentioned, his misrule. His garden grows thick with weeds and sycophants and things like that. But does that mean Bolingbroke is right, that what Bolingbroke does is right?
Right. And he certainly never says that. Shakespeare himself, obviously. There's no narrator, right, the way there is in Henry V. There isn't one in Richard II. It's certainly not clear when you read the play, but it's one of the great explorations of what is a king for. Is a king there to remind us of the kingship of God, not to be worshipped as a god himself, but to remind us of the kingship of God? Or is the king there for prudential reasons, to direct the government in an effective way? And here the tension arises when the king, who's good at drama and showing himself to create a, an awe-inspiring court. That's certainly Richard II. He's himself a poet. He has all the great lines. Bolingbroke is nothing like that, but he's a more beloved leader, right? When he overthrows Richard II at the end, the crowd is cheering for Bolingbroke. And there's a great line where they compare, I forgot the exact phrase, but they compare Richard II to someone who's slinking off the stage or something like that, where, you know, someone who's not wanted anymore. Mm-hmm. So is the job of a king to cultivate awe or to be beloved by his people? And mm-hmm. and this is a tension that exists in Jewish tradition in a very interesting way. Because whether or not we believe that kingship was an ideal, and this is debated in the Talmud and in the Midrash originally, whether kingship was always part of the plan or not. Mm-hmm. Once kingship becomes part of the plan, on the one hand, the Bible emphasizes that you have to be very careful lest the king become an idol. The Hebrew phrase is levilti yarum levavo me'achav, lest his heart become haughty above his brethren. And of course, that's precisely the crime that is Richard's sin. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the Talmud does emphasize that you have to have awe for the king, shetehei mato alecha, that is, awe be on you. So how do you, on the one hand, cultivate awe for the kingship as a reminder of the kingship of God without the king himself becoming an idol or becoming self-centered or narcissistic? Mm-hmm. David is chosen as king, not because he doesn't have flaws, but because he is able to walk this balance perfectly. Because he's, on the one hand, he's a gifted king who's loved by the people, but he gives all credit for his success to God rather than to himself. He refuses to be divinized. Mm-hmm. And that's why David is the political actor par excellence. But you only see hints of that in Shakespeare's kings, only maybe after a little bit after Henry V, right after Agincourt, not before Agincourt, but only after Agincourt, when Henry says that he would declare the death penalty on anyone who will take credit for the battle, because all credit goes to God. Right. And he declares that they will sing the pronobis, which is in Hebrew, lo lanu Hashem, lo lanu ki l'shimcha tein kavod, the psalm, not to us, but to you, God, give glory. But you only see that among Shakespeare's kings very, very briefly. So Shakespeare is throughout all these plays, is examining the tension and what it means to be a king. That's what makes these plays so wonderful. I know of no greater work. I don't mean in literature. I mean in political thought, where these tensions are examined. I think Richard II, Henry IV, Henry V are some of the great works of political thought ever written.
So to build on, within that language, Richard's language, that's so impressive, but also what sets him apart, but also could possibly contribute to his downfall. He actually both backhandedly compliments Bolingbroke, you know, the future Henry IV's ability to be among the people and to deflect credit in that way. And when he's kind of complaining to his groups, he reminds of Bushy and Bagot and Green and his sycophants to that. He says that he's observed his courtship of the common people and Richard's very critical of the fact that Bolingbroke courts the people. It should be the other way around. And in this kind of divine right of kings political theology, authority in Richard's mind is issued from the top down. And he's very resentful of Bolingbroke kind of, you know, gathering and building authority from the bottom up. He's very upset that, you know, off goes his bonnet to an oyster wench. Like, the king should not be available to the people in that way. Do you see that as a fault in Bolingbroke, or did you see that as kind
no,
of
so, no, divided? So I think that's the thing. I think that in the Jewish vision of in the biblical vision of kingship, mm-hmm. and the king and the vision of kingship that you see in Jewish political tradition, the goal is to combine the gifts of Richard and the virtues of Bolingbroke. Mm-hmm. So Maimonides writes, Maimonides is one of the more pro-monarchy voices in the Jewish political and legal tradition. There are more negative writers about monarchy in general, but Maimonides is not one of them. And yet Maimonides, in describing the biblical concern, lest the king's heart grow haughty above his brethren, he has a wonderful phrase where he says, but the Bible was particularly concerned about the king's heart because, and the Hebrew is, ki libo hu lev kol kahal Yisrael, The king's heart is the heart of all the people. Meaning true kingship is expanding one's heart to encompass everyone. So to pick up on your point about Bolingbroke being available to the people, there's a striking point by Joseph Soloveitchik, quoting this Maimonidean statement. He cites the story of King Solomon. And one of the most famous stories of King Solomon is the judgment of the two mothers. Two women come before him, each claiming that a child is respectively their son. And he decides, he discerns who the true mother is. Everyone tells the story, but few know that these two women are harlots. That's what it says. Azbar shtei nashim zonot. So now Solomon was the one king in biblical history to truly rule over a superpower. Right? So in the classical model, the ancient model of kingship, no way could two women described by the Bible here walk into the throne room of the king to have their grievances adjudicated. But with Solomon, they just walk straight in. It's unthinkable, right? The obvious contrast is to the book of Esther, where even the king's wife can't come in without an appointment. And here, two women from certainly not nobility, right, go walk straight in to adjudicate their claim, to have the king's wisdom adjudicate their claim. So the way Rabbi Soloveitchik puts it is the Jewish king must be open to everybody. On the other end, Solomon does sit on a throne. He does remind us of the kingship of God. That is in part what his job is. How you balance these two is very hard. And what happens if you have a descendant of the king who inherits the monarchy, who is haughty, who's not able? What do you do and what is your recourse? That's not an easy question to answer at all. And Shakespeare's creating the drama by taking different gifts. And one man is able to reenact the drama of kingship. And one man is a man of the people. Now what happens? But the man who's a man of the people is not the heir. And he's not the current heir. He could be, in theory, Richard II's heir, right? Richard II says things like that. But what happens then when this split occurs? And that's the drama. And then, of course, by Bolingbroke overthrowing Richard II, he makes overthrowing a king thinkable, so that then in Henry IV, he has to deal with rebellions against him. And that's in part his fault, whether it was right to overthrow Richard II or not, because now it's totally thinkable. Once the very people that helped him overthrow Richard II now turn against him. So that's part of the tension that Shakespeare's examining. But these are themes that play out in the Bible throughout, which is why, from the Jewish perspective, there are very few great kings. You can count the great kings on your hand. Mm-hmm. There are great kings in the Bible, but very few. Very few. And for rabbinic tradition, there's probably, if we think about the kings that ruled over Judea or Israel, not queens like Esther, there's maybe four great kings, maybe, and one great queen, which would be Shlom Tzion, the queen of the during the second temple period during the Hasmonean dynasty. Mm-hmm. I think as far as my royalties is concerned, if I were thinking about it. So it's very rare to have, out of any number of tens of kings, there are very few that were truly great.
That percentage tracks, I think, into Shakespeare as well. There are very few great kings. Right. There are plenty of kings, very few great kings. I mean, it's interesting. Emma Smith kind of, in her reading of Richard II, she says that the great unanswered question in this play is whether it was right, historically, politically, ethically, personally, dramatically, for Bolingbroke to take the throne from his cousin Richard. The play leaves it unanswered. Right. We could debate whether or not that's true. Macbeth is different, and I wonder if we could push ourselves there.
Sure.
That question is not part of the play. Maybe it is to a certain extent, but Duncan, the overthrown, murdered king, is established as a great king. He touches the citizens, right? He has the gift that it is believed the anointing of God. He can heal through touch. When Macduff discovers his murdered body, he calls the Lord's anointed temple. That question isn't present, but we have other questions that go back to the David-Saul problem of what do you do, with this concept of prophecy? So David's solution, it sounds like what you're saying, was to let, you know, if this was God's action, God needs to make it happen. And he refrains all the way through. That makes him a good leader or not a good leader in a sense? Like, what kind of leadership are we seeing there?
For David, it makes him the greatest leader, I think, because and my own theory, and we discussed this in our classes, in our seminars, my own theory is that in Macbeth, people try to connect Macbeth to the David and Saul story because it's the play with witches, and Saul is the only biblical king who also consults witches, or at least one witch, really a necromancer of some sort from Endor, the Witch of Endor. But another way of looking at it, my own theory of looking at Macbeth, is that Shakespeare is giving us David in reverse, because David, that phrase which you mentioned when Duncan is killed, that the Lord's anointed temple, right, has been murdered. That's very similar to the phrase that David himself enunciates when he explains why he doesn't want to strike Saul. The story is that Saul is in a cave. David could take him out, and he doesn't do that. Instead, he just cuts off a bit of Saul's cloak to show him that he could have gotten to him, that he's really loyal and would not kill him. And then we're told that David's heart smote him for even taking that cloak, piece of cloak off, because he stretched out his hand to the Lord's anointed. Now, does that make him a... So we have David, who's told by the prophet Samuel that he will be king. And we have Macbeth, who's told by the weird sisters, by the witches. And weird here means fate, right? Mm-hmm. That he will be king. The question Macbeth struggles with is, what does that mean? Should he take action to make himself king? Or should he let things play out? They called him Thane of Kodar, right? Even though he wasn't yet. And that played out on its own. So why can't he let his kingship play out on his own? And he doesn't do that, in part because of his wife tells him not to. And his wife basically tells him to, she says, you know, you gotta... You got to seize the throne. He is giving us a David in reverse. The greatness of David is that he is one of the few monarchs who can simultaneously show greatness and humility, or to use a phrase from Rabbi Soloveitchik, majesty and humility. Mm-hmm. He is sometimes incredibly active and sometimes incredibly passive. And even when he's active, he sees God's hand. So, no one else, everyone else is afraid to kill Goliath. He kills Goliath, but he gives all credit for it to God. Someone has rebelled against him, a Shimei of the house of Saul. And David understands that this is part of his punishment for his own sin with Bathsheba, the prophecy punishment. And so he doesn't kill Shimei at that point for the rebellion against him, because he wants to let God's punishment against him play out. He wants to let his own atonement play out. And so there is one way of reading, one way of saying Macbeth is that Duncan is a great king for Macbeth, for Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. But the other way of seeing it is that Shakespeare is trying to flatter another king, which is, of course, James, right? James is the new king. And James is supposed to be a descendant, I think, of the man who refuses to take action, even though it's also prophesied that he will be the ancestor of kings. Mm-hmm. And that is Banquo. Right. Mm-hmm. And so Banquo was also told your descendants will be kings of Scotland. But he doesn't seize the throne from Duncan. He could also seize the throne, right, as scholars point out, and give it to his children. But he doesn't. And James was to be the descendant of Banquo. So this is a way of flattering the new king of England and Scotland by saying this is a truly great king. Whether he was or he wasn't is a separate question. But here too, Shakespeare is as it were addressing, just by the contrast between Banquo and Macbeth, what a truly great king is. Now, of course, there's all sorts of politics that goes on in there, and all sorts of things that everyone watching the play would have known behind the scenes, because everyone knows that watching it, that James has inherited the throne from Elizabeth, who some believe was the rightful monarch, and some believe was not. And everyone knows that James's mother was herself executed, right? Mm-hmm. And she was herself a monarch, and all sorts. And what does it mean to execute a monarch? So there's all that going on behind the scenes, of course. But here too, if you think about this from a biblical perspective, it's an incredibly fruitful subject on Macbeth to think about and to inspire further conversation.
You're right. We will never fully cover this topic in this conversation. There's so much to unpack here. But you mentioned David's virtue as being one of humility, that a king needs to be humble. And it reminds me of this wonderful moment in Richard II. Sorry to go back there too, where I wonder what you make of that pathos moment where Richard sits with his courtiers on the ground.
The greatest moment. And farewell, king.
Yes. And he says, you know, you've mistook me.
I live with bread like you. Feel want. Taste grief. Need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me, I am a king?
There's so much to do with that. Is it asking, you know, the audience that how can you say to me that the power of a king comes from acknowledgement and consent of the people? Does the king need it? What did you make of this moment?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to what he says there. The final part is asking about what does it mean in a plaintive way. And it's sort of the only moment of true self-revelation, right, for Richard, that he is holding himself out, as I said before, as a god. And yet in one moment, he shows that it's entirely false. But why is he like that? He's like that because he loses it for a minute. He's ready. He's expecting an army, right, to come help him against Bolingbroke. And it doesn't show. And he has one moment of despair. But to me, the most interesting part of that, so he says, how can you say I'm a king because I need friends, I'm a human being, and so on and so forth. And so he's raising the question of, isn't his whole approach to kingship, right, that he rules, as it were, by some form of divine right, right? Well, not just divine right, but that he himself has made himself some semi-divine. Doesn't his own experience belie that? But to me, the most interesting part of that speech is what comes earlier when he says, for God's sake, let's sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed. And then he says famously, for within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court. What does it mean when he calls his crown hollow and that he thinks about the death of kings? And so here he's onto something incredibly profound, which is that to be a king in the ancient world or in the classical world or in the world of Britain of Richard II is when? 1390s, 1399? When is, okay, is to be constantly worried about being overthrown. You are claiming yourself to be the all-powerful individual, and yet all you can think about, all you obsess about, is someone getting to you. For me, the best example of this in the Bible is Ahasuerus, right? Meaning this is a man who is haunted by the possibility of being overthrown and murdered. There is a plot against him. They know that it was uncovered. Mm-hmm. And if there's one plot, there's going to be more. This is a paranoid king who's on the one hand having a massive party with pomp to show his great power and largesse, and yet he's constantly paranoid of being as Richard II, all of a sudden, farewell king. So to say the crown is hollow, I mean, tell me what you think, and I think this is the meaning, is to say, and probably others have said this, is to say that you wear the crown, but in theory, it's not affixed to your head, right? It's hollow. There's a hole in the middle. Anyone can wear it, right? The famous misquoted line of the man who becomes Henry IV, Bolingbroke. The original line is, uneasy lies the head that wears the crown. It bears the crown. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The way people often quote it is that the crown is heavy when you wear it. But it's the opposite. He says those words when he's in bed, when he's not, the one time of day when he's not wearing the crown. And so when the crown is off your head, you can imagine someone else wearing it. And of course, there's this scene at the end of Henry IV, right? Where Henry V, or Hal, as his father is dying, put the crown on his head. And his father says, oh, you couldn't wait for me to die before you put the crown on your head. And so to be a king is to, on the one hand, hold yourself out as this enormously all-powerful figure, and potentially, if you allow society to idolize you as Richard II does, to turn yourself into a semi-divine figure. And yet you know at any point you could be killed, you could be overthrown, and that ultimately you will die, and the words that were said about you will be said about someone else. The king is dead, long live the king. Mm-hmm. And that's a tension that's being played up here in that incredible speech. One of the best speeches about monarchy that there is. And his only moment of true honesty, really, I think, Richard II in the play. Maybe there's more, but this is the most raw honesty and an incredible reflection about the nature of kingship and what it means to be a king. That's, David on his deathbed is telling his young son Solomon, you have enormous dangers to your monarchy. If you want your monarchy to survive, here's what you need to do. And at times you're going to need to be brutal. Mm-hmm. To be a king is to know there are always people who want to overthrow you. It's a scary part of kingship. And that's the theme of the Hollow Crown.
Right. That constant paranoia, of course, is, completely embodied in Macbeth. Maybe not the best line, not the Hollow Crown line, but when Macbeth is installed on the throne, he does say, to be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus. Now, I think the mistake, perhaps from a Torah lens here, that Macbeth is making is that he thinks all of his threats are from his enemies, right? They're other people. But there is this element within Jewish thought that the safety, of the king, the anointed one being installed, is that he also has to be mindful of his moral responsibility. That is in part something that will secure, to a degree, right, his leadership.
That's exactly right. If you believe in providence, and if you believe that you are truly the anointed of God, well, that means you have to believe. Now, to what extent traditional faith plays a role in the Macbeth as a play is a separate question, right? Because it's not It's not like Richard II. It's not set in the same way in a Christian society. Mm-hmm. But there's no archbishop who anoints the king.
And there's no need at the end to pilgrimage to the Holy Land to wash the guilt from your hands. Absolutely.
Right, exactly. And so...
Different washing.
Right, exactly. That doesn't play out there. And it could well be that, this is a whole separate theory, that what Shakespeare is giving us in Macbeth is what happens to a society that believes only in fate. I don't know that that's the right reading, but that has a pagan approach to fate rather than a biblical approach to, let's say, freedom and destiny. That's one way of thinking about it. I don't think that's the right. That's the right reading of Macbeth. Meaning, I think Marjorie Garber is right that there is a dual meaning to everything, and the choice remains theirs. And so Macbeth makes one choice, and Banquo makes another choice. But I do think that if Abraham Lincoln wrote to a Shakespearean actor that his favorite play is Macbeth, right, which is a very strange thing to say for somebody who, in his own life as a statesman, is maybe the least person like Macbeth ever, right?
Absolutely.
I think it's because the themes that play out in Macbeth are the themes that Lincoln during the Civil War was struggling with. Mm-hmm. How much of this is decreed by God? How much of it is punishment for earlier sins of America? Mm-hmm. And he ends up exploring that in the second inaugural. I think the greatest speech in American history, and maybe the greatest speech in the history of the English language, because of all it incorporates. It's the themes of Macbeth of how one sin, blood will have blood, right? As he says, others note this to Lincoln in this context, to what extent, and then Lincoln himself says that, there's a point made by others, that the lashes of slavery are now being repaid in the blood of the Civil War. So Lincoln, the themes of Macbeth, how one sin, how blood can lead to blood, and the struggle between, on the one hand, freedom, and to what extent you are the actor and to what extent you are being acted upon. Those are themes that Lincoln was incredibly interested in. And those are themes that Shakespeare is exploring in Macbeth. And that's why I think the man who's we see as the moral archetype of the opposite of who Macbeth is, right, was so interested in this play and thought it was a better play than Hamlet. I'm no Shakespearean scholar, but I'm sympathetic to that personally. I mean, Hamlet's long, Professor Trevino. I mean, that's a long play. You know, there's a lot going on there. Macbeth is not short and sweet, but short and profound. So, you know,
Certainly. Well, maybe we'll have to bring you back to have a conversation about Lincoln and Shakespeare another time.
Oh, that would be terrific. Maybe
so
we
teaser.
What we'll need to do is we'll need to bring on Professor Harold Holter, and we could do it together with him, my
I'd
co-teacher for the Lincoln course, which would be amazing.
I love it. Thank you so much. This has been enlightening and so wonderfully useful to us, you know, as we think about these concepts today, really about the questions that we're still seeing about inheritance of responsibility and to what extent we need to be, you know, actors versus passive, you know, recipients in our own history. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you for listening to Twice Blessed, a project of the Yeshiva University Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. This show is produced by Uri Westrich and Sam Gelman. Information about this episode, including the audio credits and reading recommendations, is available in the show notes. If this conversation left you feeling blessed, please subscribe to Twice Blessed on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and consider leaving a positive review, sharing it with friends, and following us on social media. Thanks for listening.